Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at hrnradio.com.
Welcome to Kindred Spirits. It's my show on healthylife.net, and I am Lynn Andrews, and my show is on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. As a shaman author of the Medicine Woman series, I am a teacher, lecturer, and I have a very special vision about the people that I invite to join us. I see their beauty and their accomplishments and of extraordinary efforts that my guests, in a sacred way, they are creators of wisdom and knowledge and share their experiences with the world community. We appreciate their work and celebrate their value to all of us. Today, we have a renowned author. She has written a new book called The Perfect Horse, and her name is Elizabeth Letts. She is a New York Times bestselling author of The $80 Champion, as well as two novels, Quality of Care and Family Planning. She's a competitive equestrian in her youth, and Letts rode for California in the North American Junior Three-Day Eventing Championships. She currently lives in Southern California. And welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you're so welcome. And I think some of my people are going to say, why am I interviewing someone who wrote a book about horses? And I just want to say that I am a shaman by training, and the ability to ride a horse in dressage, in the incredible precision and ability and practice and strength of a liposomer, for instance, ergo the perfect horse, is something that is shamanic in my estimation. It takes the most extraordinary skill of the rider to perfect their skill and then perfect the skill of the horse along with you. It's an incredible endeavor. So, Elizabeth, I am so thrilled, truly, to be talking with you. And you've written such an extraordinary book about the daring U.S. mission to rescue the priceless stallions that were kidnapped by the Nazis. And can you tell my listeners a bit about your book, if you will?
Absolutely. Well, this is a true story, and it's something that happened just at the end of World War II. One of the most incredible heroic acts that was done by our American soldiers, and yet it's not as well known as many of the other things that happened in World War II. During World War II, Europe had some of the most beautiful and extraordinary purebred horses in the world, whether it be Arabian horses that were bred in Poland or the famous white Lipizzaner who lived in Austria. And Hitler wanted all of these horses. He wanted them because he wanted to breed a perfect race of horses. So to take those same diabolical ideas that he was applying to humans and then applying them to horses as well. So he went around Europe systematically gathering up all of these beautiful horses and hiding them on a secret farm in Czechoslovakia. At the very end of the war, these horses were right in the path of the Russian army. And the Russians were advancing and would have gotten to where the horses were and slaughtered them to feed their troops. They would kill the horses and eat them during the war. And as it turned out, the only group of people that were nearby with a small band of American soldiers. And the Germans who were in charge of these horses were so desperate to find a solution that they actually reached out to this group of American soldiers to ask if they might be able to help. Now, if you can think about during the war, there was a lot going on right then, you know, in terms of, the war wasn't over yet, and there were people in concentration camps, and there was desperation everywhere. For some reason that I believe was truly meant to be, you could not make this up, the people, these American soldiers, they weren't just ordinary soldiers. They were cavalry soldiers. They were some of America's last great soldier horsemen. And they had had their horses taken away before they went off to war. But they were horsemen deep inside of them. And so, as it happened, they organized a secret mission to go across enemy lines to try to get these horses out safely.
Well, it's extraordinary, and people have to remember that there were still cavalry horses. There were still horses being used within the war itself. Mm-hmm. And as you explained so beautifully how the Nazis wanted to provide or find or breed this perfect race of horses.
That's right. And one of the things that really surprised me when I was doing my research that I didn't know, and I think most people don't know, was that we don't associate World War II with horses. We associate World War II with airplanes and tanks.
Right.
But in fact, there were many, many horses used during the war. And many of the people, many of the soldiers, and especially the generals and the high-ups, there was still quite a debate going on about whether war could even be waged without horses. There were two camps, the ones that believed that everything should be tanks and jeeps, and there was the other side that said, no, you know, you can never, those machines can never do what a horse does. And so there was a lot of debating. And the idea of breeding the perfect horse, they wanted to breed the perfect war horse, the perfect military horse.
And they trained them differently, didn't they, than the Lipizzaners. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. Well, the horses that they wanted to train to use as war horses, they wanted very specific. They wanted them to have very specific qualities. So, first of all, they wanted them to be very calm. I mean, if you can imagine, it's terrifying to be in battle, and so a war horse has to be brave and not be afraid when there are loud noises and things like that. They wanted them to be hardy, so they could survive on not very much food. And they wanted them to be very solid so that they wouldn't, go lame if they had to go over large, long distances and that kind of thing. But the horses that they wanted to train to be war horses were actually horses that had so much of a higher purpose than to be gone, to go into the danger of the war. And that's one of the things that I really talk about in the book, is that these were not ordinary horses. These were extraordinary horses.
And did they use the Lipizzaners for war horses at one point?
They did not. So the Lipizzaner horses were the royal horses of Austria. And in particular, they were bred to do these very high-level dressage movements where it was such a rarefied art form. It's almost like, for people who aren't familiar with dressage, it's like ballet dancing for horses. Very, very beautiful, but it takes many years to train a horse to do these things. And only the best horses really are even capable of learning to do it, the most patient, the most intelligent. So that's what the Lipizzaner, these white horses, were bred to do, those special balletic movements. But the Germans had the idea that, well, the balletic movement's not that important. It's an art form. No, we're going to try to use the horses as war horses. Because the war ended, they really never got far enough in their project to be able to put the Lipizzaners into war situations.
Thank God.
Thank God. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Where did the Lipizzaners originate, do you think?
Well, the horses, the reason that they're called Lipizzaners is that they were originally bred in a place called Lipica.
Say that again.
Lipica, or Lipica in English. And it's in present-day Slovenia. So it's a part of the world that has sort of been in different countries at different times. The location stayed the same, and the countries kind of changed around it. So,
yeah.
But it's in current-day Slovenia. And that is where these horses were originally bred, and they were bred for the Habsburg emperors, who were the monarchs of the, all of Central Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were bred there, and then after World War I, these horses were so valuable that they were divided up like you would divide up crown jewels or something.
Mm-hmm.
And there were very few horses to start out with. A third were given to Austria. A third of them stayed in Slovenia, and another third went to Yugoslavia. So they were divided into three parts, but very, very rare. So in the entire world, there were probably only about 2,000 or 3,000 of these purebred horses at this time.
My goodness. Where is there any way that you can look at the bloodlines of these horses?
The ones that were rescued, or just in general?
In general today.
In general, today, it's not difficult to find the bloodlines of the horses. In fact, a lot of times you can find them even if you just Google the horse's name. A lot of them have their bloodlines are easy to find. There's also the North American Limpets Honor Association, which keeps pedigrees of all the purebred Limpets Honor.
North American?
Mm-hmm. Well, here in the United States, yeah.
So they brought a lot of the Limpets Honors to this country then?
Some of them. We have some here, and the majority of them are still in Europe.
Gosh, that's so incredible. Describe the Spanish riding school that is actually in Vienna.
Well, the Spanish riding school, the first thing that confuses everyone is why the Spanish riding school is called Spanish. And so that's a very interesting question. The Spanish riding school was built back in the 1600s.
And really? Wow.
Yes, it was for royal horses to perform for the emperor. And they only performed in private. So if you were just an average person, you could not go to watch these horses perform. You had to be invited by the emperor. And they were called Spanish because the horses, this type of horse originally was bred in Spain. When I say the type of horse, it's a horse that was a little bit lighter and more refined than the usual horses.
Would that be the Andalusian?
Like the Andalusians, right.
Uh-huh.
So up in Europe at this time, the horses were heavy, cold-blooded, like work horses mostly.
Uh-huh.
And then you had the Arabian horse, which was a very beautiful, brilliant, and very light-footed, refined horses. When these horses started coming up into Europe and they started breeding them with the heavier European horses, they started to be called Spanish-style horses, and they became very, very popular.
What is that again? Stanislaw?
Spanish style.
Oh, Spanish style. I'm sorry.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they became very popular. So back in, say, 1600, 1700, every prince would have a royal stable, and every stable would breed these kinds of horses. And so that was why there's a school in Vienna, and it's called the Spanish Riding School, because they were riding in this Spanish style.
I see.
At the time, there were hundreds of these all over Europe. Now, in 2016, the last one that's left is the Spanish Riding School of Vienna.
And isn't that a shame?
Yes,
I mean, it's
incredible.
Wonderful. At least it exists. But
yes, and it survived against all odds, which is one of the things that I do talk a lot in my book, that it was really the Spanish Riding School, even during World War II, it was the last place where they were carrying on this tradition of classical dressage, which had been passed on through the years from one master rider to another for centuries and centuries. And if it had not been for the brave people who put their lives on the line to save the school and these horses, that wouldn't exist at all. It would be gone. But fortunately, it did survive the war. And if you go to Vienna now, one of the very most favorite things for people to do is to go to visit this Spanish riding school. It's a very beautiful building. It's Baroque. It's an indoor riding hall with just elaborate high ceilings covered with beautiful Baroque architecture and sculpture. And this was this hall where the emperors and their guests used to watch the horses perform, and you can still go there and you can still see the horses perform just as they did. And it's one of the most beautiful and awe-inspiring things, I think, that I've ever seen.
Yeah, just fabulous. And speaking again about your book, you did, Elizabeth, the most extraordinary job of research.
Thank you.
So much, so many things that I don't think most people ever even knew about.
Yes. Well, I have to say, and thank you so much for saying that. I really do appreciate it, because it really was a labor of love. I had been interested in these beautiful white horses, the Limpets Honor, since I was a little girl. And
mm-hmm.
But it never occurred to me that there was any kind of new story to tell there. And the way that I discovered the story, it was really, I came across it by accident when I was doing research on my previous book, The $80 Champion. I was
uh-huh.
in an equestrian library, and I was looking at some pamphlets that had to do with the U.S. Army Cavalry. And one of the pamphlets, it said a parade of European horses. And so I opened it. It was just like a little flimsy kind of paper mimeographed thing.
Yeah.
And I opened it up, and inside there were the names of these horses that they were showing at an army base in Virginia in 1946, so just 1 year after the end of the war.
Oh, my gosh.
There were Lipizzaner, and then there were also these Polish Arabians, among them Vitej, who's one of the equestrian heroes of my book.
Vitej, you're talking about?
Yes, a beautiful Polish Arabian. And so,
oh, he was gorgeous.
Yes,
gorgeous.
You're familiar with him. So he, so I saw this, and the thing that really caught my attention was that somebody, way back when, had scribbled notes in pencil into this program. It was like a program. They said things like, these are the most magnificent horses in the world, the most beautiful, extraordinary. And so it really caught my attention. I just thought, well, how did these horses get here and why are they here? What does this mean? So I started to look into it. And when I looked into it, that's when I discovered that these horses had been saved by the American Army at the end of World War II. And so there had been some previous, I guess, magazine articles, and there was even a movie that was made by Walt Disney. I don't know if you ever saw it. Back in the early 1960s, I had never seen it. It was a little bit before my time. And each one of these told kind of a little piece of the story, but nobody ever had really delved in to find out what had really happened. And that's what I decided to do. And I did not know what a big project it was going to be. It took me 4 years to do
it. I bet it did.
You know, so it was really, you know, and then to just really, there's a lot of characters and a lot of different horses, a lot of locations, a lot of different places. And it took a long time for me to figure out how to spin that out into a story that was not only, you know, that would be interesting to read. And that's the thing with history is I feel so passionate about history.
And, yes.
I want someone who picks up one of my books to not even feel that they're reading. I want them to feel that they just effortlessly turn the pages, that it's, you know, the truth is as exciting as the story that somebody made up. If you do it right, but it takes a lot of work to get it. You have to figure out the story so it will be exciting, you know.
And it was so interesting about Patton. Talk a little bit about that.
So one of the things that was interesting in the story was that General Patton was a very, very big horseman himself. He competed in the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm in the sport of modern pentathlon, which includes a riding component.
Patton did?
Yes, he did, yes. And he was a very passionate polo player and fox hunter, just a passionate horseman.
Yeah, and I knew that, but I didn't know he'd been in the Olympics. Oh, my goodness.
He was in the Olympics, yes. So he figures into the story because, of course, he was the general, the head of the Third Army, but he also happened to be acquainted with a man by the name of Colonel Charles Hancock Reed. He went by the name of Hank. Hank Reed was the man in charge when the Germans came and said, "Can you help us to save the horses?" And Hank Reed himself was a fabulous horseman, but he also knew Patton personally because they were both polo players. So when Reed had to get Patton's permission to go in and do this rescue attempt on the horses, he knew Patton, and he knew that Patton loved horses. And so Patton was the one kind of behind the scenes who said, "I'm going to let you go in and get the horses." Once they were rescued then, the next thing that Patton did that was very, very important was that he agreed to put all of the Lipizzaner and the Spanish Riding School itself under American protection so that they would make it. They lived through the war, but there really was no place for them to go back to at that time. You know, obviously it was right after the war, and they had fled Vienna, and they couldn't go back because Vienna was occupied by the Russians. And Patton said, "Nope, as long as you need protection of the American army, we will protect you." And had it not been for that, the Spanish Riding School never would have survived.
Yeah, they were surrounded by Russians troops,
yes.
Weren't they? They were not in Vienna, but somewhere else trying to escape, right?
Right. They had fled out of Vienna, and the Russians actually went into Vienna, and they were. But the Lipizzaner ended up in the American zone. So, in the American zone.
Elizabeth, we'll be right back after station identification, and hold that thought, if you will.
Timeless information for your self-care and health. HRNradio.com.
I am speaking with Elizabeth Letts, who has written this just magnificent book called The Perfect Horse. And you were just talking about, before the break, about Patton and how General Patton got involved with all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So General Patton, had it not been for the fact that he was a true horseman and that he saw the value of these horses, I think that the horses would have been, even having made it through the war, they certainly would have been lost in the chaos that ensued when the war was over. I mean, there wasn't enough food for people. There were a lot of people who thought that it was pointless to feed horses, that it would be better to slaughter the horses and use the meat to feed people. And so his strength in standing up for the horses was a really important component of them ending up being saved. And they were truly irreplaceable, so thank God.
Well, thank heaven. Thank heaven he helped, because it was extraordinary. Elizabeth talks about having to take the breeding barns on the road with mares with little tiny babies and some mares in foal, and how the stallions would run away. I think the Wheatez himself and a couple of his colts run away at one point, and it actually saved their lives.
They did, and yes, I think so one of the things that when I started to research this book that I hadn't fully understood was we've been talking a lot about the Lipizzaner of Austria, but in fact the Germans had seized two different groups of horses. The two groups of horses that were considered the most valuable horses in Europe were the Lipizzaner from Austria and then the Arabians that were bred in Poland. And the horses in Poland came under the most harrowing circumstances. Worse, actually, they were in more danger than the Austrian horses because of their location. They were being bred in a part of Poland that was very, very close to the Russian border. So right when the war first broke out, they were in the line of fire, not just once but twice. The Russian army pushed forward and was coming toward the farm where they were. The Germans were advancing from the other side, and they were caught in the middle. And so the incredibly brave horsemen, and this is where you really see what the horse and human bond can be. The people would make sacrifices for these horses. When you read it, it's hard to believe. You wonder what you would do if you were in the same circumstance. They took all of the horses, so this is stallions, mares, and foals, and they fled on foot, and they were trying to flee. They had picked a destination that was hundreds of miles away that they were going to try to travel with this big group of horses overland to try to find a safe place. They couldn't really go east, and they couldn't go west. So they were trying to go to, you know, I don't know, south, I guess it was, to some country that would be safe, but it was really far away. So they take off in one direction, and soon enough, they run into the Russians that are marching towards them. And the Russians have no regard for the horses. They'll just shoot them on the spot. The horses were frightened, and some of them ran away. And among the ones that ran away was the horse Wheatez, who was just 1 year old at the time, but he was really the most, you know, considered the most extraordinary horse in Poland at the time. And he ran away into the woods, and they couldn't go get the horses that ran away because it was so imperative for them to keep moving, that they ended up leaving the ones, just leaving them. They didn't know what would happen to them. But these horses were, they were very beloved of the people. And so we don't really know for sure when the horses ran away. It's possible that some of the farmers along the way may have recognized them and, you know, tried to help them. So he ended up running away, and he was missing for a while, but then he ended up coming back, and he did survive the war.
Oh, my God, what an incredible story. Wheatez, where did he come from? Did he come from Egypt or the Middle East?
He was born in Poland, and he was I believe it was his grandsire, was an Arabian, desert Arabian, who had been imported from the Arabian Peninsula.
Uh-huh.
But he was actually bred and born in Poland.
My gosh, what an extraordinary story. It's incredible how you show so beautifully the relationship between the horses and the men who ride them, and how each rider had a horse that they specifically worked on and rode through the years. Is that true?
Yes. So one of the things, this is now I'm going to be talking about the Spanish Riding School again. One of the incredible traditions that they have is that people, at the time it was all men. Now actually they have women and men riders. But the boys would come in when they were about 11, 12 years old, and they were basically apprenticed as riders.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
yes,
fabulous.
If they kept making the cut, they had to be, you know, really good. But if they kept making the cut as they went through this training program, they were eventually accepted into the school, and then they would stay for life. And so they would be partnered with these young horses and train them. And it was a very much a one-man, one-horse. They would take them, they would train them, they would teach them, and then they would stay with them for, you know, 10, 12, 14, 20 years throughout these horses' performing careers. So they had this very, very deep bond of communication. And if you watch the horses and riders performing, what you see that's so incredible is that the riders, they barely move. They're just... they almost kind of fade into the background as you really concentrate on the horses that they're riding and what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And yet the movements that they're doing are extraordinarily difficult. And so they've reached this point of communication. And riders can communicate with their horses with a variety of different means. They can use sometimes voice or sounds. They can use pressure on the reins. They can use their weight on their seat and how they shift on the seat bones. And then the pressure of their legs against the horse's barrel. So they have a variety of different ways to talk to a horse. But it becomes so subtle that it's almost as if the rider and the horse are speaking their own private language and communicating with each other. And
well, they really are.
Yes, yes, they really are. And that's what I find to be so extraordinarily beautiful and inspiring about horsemanship in general, is this idea that you have two sentient beings, a human and a horse, and they develop this exquisitely fine-tuned communication. And of course, if you stay with the same horse, you know, year after year after year, they are a true partnership in every sense of the word.
Yeah, it's a magnificent, magnificent thing to see, and it's so shamanic. I don't know if you know, Elizabeth, anything about shamanism, but you know, it's about energy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can ride a horse and you can think ahead in the show ring what
yes.
you need to do or where you need to go, and the horse just follows it.
Yes, yes. Oh, I know I can tell just by what you're saying that you're a horsewoman as well, because that's one of the things that really draws me to horse stories, because, and I think it's even people who don't, we have a lot of people now who've never really personally experienced horses, and so they feel, maybe they think that they're beautiful at a distance, but they don't necessarily really understand what that means. But if you've ever been an animal person, a cat person, or a dog person, it's very much the same. And with horses, you a very skilled rider, it reaches a point where you're not thinking, let me kick this horse with my leg and pull on the rein or anything like that. You're thinking, now my horse is going to do a fine change, and without
yes,
quite,
the horse will do it.
It will do it, yes.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you're moving imperceptibly that nobody can see on the outside.
Exactly.
We'll be right back after station identification. Hold that thought, Elizabeth, if you will.
Okay.
Like what you hear? Tell your friends. Thanks for listening to HRNradio.com.
I am speaking with Elizabeth Letts, again, who's written a book called The Perfect Horse, which is really not only about these magnificent horses called the Lipus Honors and the Arabians, and somewhat about the war horses. She is talking about an extraordinary time that, you know, has been filmed and, you know, some people have lived through. And this is the most fascinating mystery story. It's just so exciting. You're waiting and waiting in these different chapters for something, the enemy to come, and they're surrounded by so many enemies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the things that was extraordinary to read. And what do you feel was the most important thing about writing The Perfect Horse?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think for me, I think a lot about how horses in particular were so deeply important to humans for such a long, long time. We really developed alongside them. We used them to fight our wars, to plow our fields, to pull our you know, vehicles, to take us on our travels. And it was such a deep and important bond. And in the last, you know, maybe 25 years or so, more and more people are a little bit more distanced from that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So I feel like in looking back and bringing alive a story from not the not-so-distant past, but long enough ago, to show how profound that human-animal link and our link to horses that I believe very strongly that we should maintain, because I think it has a deep spiritual component to it, it really comes clear when you put these people and their horses in the terrible times of the war with what was going on, and you show what humans are capable of out of love when they're inspired by their love for these you know, magnificent animals, it really brings out our better self and our better side. And that's what I wanted to try to show. This was, in my opinion, you know, the war was a terrible, sad time. But it's as if remembering how what the horses made the men feel helped them to remember the very best self, their very best selves. And that's, I think, what the animal-human bond can do for us.
Well, I think so. And the horse is kind of like an antenna between the earth and spirit, whatever
yes.
spirit means to you.
I agree, 100%.
You know, I often think, I don't know if you'll find this true or not, but when the Gutenberg press was invented, it changed the entire world so quickly.
Yes.
In early times, you had storytellers, and they would go from village to village, and they would sit around the fire with the people and tell them about what was happening in the neighboring villages, and if there was a fight going on, if something wonderful had been invented, and pray and do ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Then all of a sudden, you could read about the next village in a newspaper or a book.
Mm-hmm.
And the storytellers and the incredible respect that we had for the elders disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, a whole part of our culture, plus the respect for the elders, kind of disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the Lipizzaners and the relationship that the whole world has had with magnificent horses, and even in the Middle East and all over the world for Arabians. They saw the beauty of the horse in the Lipizzaner
mm-hmm.
and the dancing horses in Egypt, say.
Yeah.
They saw the beauty, and beauty, of course, translates into truth
yes.
in some way. And when you lose that, the horse that was everything and freedom to so many people all over the world, suddenly was you bought a car instead.
Mm-hmm.
And the horses were just forgotten about in so many ways, not
right.
in every, of course. I'm making huge generalizations.
Right.
But it kind of, to me, it kind of spoke one to the other, kind of a similar experience. What do you think?
I think what you're saying, you're really tapping into one of the sentiments that I really felt as I was writing the story, which was that we really, in a lot of ways, it was an end of an era story about technological change.
Mm-hmm.
Because the horse was, and we think of the horse having been replaced already before World War II. But when you honestly look at the history, people were still very connected to horses at that time, the middle of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
But that was really, really the end. You know, that within, you know, if you read the whole book, one of the things you find out is that within a few years after the war, that really was it. you know, the horse was replaced, and that there was no more there were no more horses in the army, and there really were no more. We gave up on the idea that we were going to have a horse utilitarian being used for things other than just, you know, obviously pleasure riding and things.
Uh-huh.
So many, many people who would have come across the horse in the course of their life and felt connected to the horse have lost that connection now. And I think that's not trivial, because we did live with our horses for thousands of years. The horse, you know, like the dog, is an animal that we really evolved alongside each other, and we really have this very deep and intuitive kind of way of communicating with those two animals in particular, dogs and horses. And sometimes, you know, I even think about, imagine the future where nobody had dogs. You know, imagine how many dogs there are now, and then just imagine they were all gone. And maybe a few people somewhere off, you know, but it was considered a real specialty thing. That's very hard to imagine for us.
It is, isn't it?
Yes, but that's almost what has happened with the horse in the last 50 years or so. But we still have, the human still has that ability to instinctively understand that the horse is a special animal for us and that it holds a special meaning and power. And that's why I believe that people respond when they see, you know, one of the things I went to recently was the Cavalia, which is a...
Oh, so fabulous.
Beautiful. And I was, somebody was kind enough to give tickets to me and my family, and we went. And I loved it so much, because I know that a lot of the people who were watching were not necessarily people who had the opportunity to be around horses. And yet it was so intuitive to understand, like you said, the beauty of the horse. And so I think of myself, many of the people who read my books are not people who really are necessarily, they don't consider themselves, you know, quote unquote horse people.
Uh-huh.
I get a lot of letters from people saying, I knew it was about horses and I'm not all that interested in horses, but it was so fascinating. Because I try to really write to a broad audience of people. And the other thing is that many of my fans are men. And we think about horses and women, you know, always.
Yeah, that's
horses,
so true, isn't
women.
It?
But men historically had deep, deep bonds with horses. And so I think that's, I think horses bring out the best in men.
Oh, I do too. We'll be back after station identification. Thank you so much. Just hold on.
Radio your way. HealthyLife.net.
We are back with Elizabeth Lips, speaking about an incredible mission that the U.S. made after stallions were kidnapped by the Nazis, priceless stallions. Elizabeth, you had something that we were talking at the break that you would like to mention.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit, and I don't want to give too much away because I hope people will actually go out and read my book, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what actually happened. I always say that I like writing true stories because you can't just cannot make up stuff. If you made up stories this good, nobody would believe you.
That's right. That's so true.
This story is one of those stories. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about what actually happened. So just to set the scene for you a little bit, we have a horse farm. It's in Czechoslovakia. And we've got the entire American Third Army. It's about 2 weeks before the end of the war. And they've advanced all the way through Germany, but they've stopped right at the border of Czechoslovakia. They don't have permission to advance any farther because they've already decided that Czechoslovakia is going to be part of the Russian sphere, and so the Americans are going to stay in Germany. And
yeah.
So you've got this army sitting there, and over on the other side, you've got this horse farm, and you've got these Germans. And the Germans, they're German military officers wearing German uniforms. And they've got the horses, and the horses, they know the Russians. They've heard that the Russians are going to be arriving at their doorstep in a matter of days, possibly hours. And they have been sworn to protect these horses. They know that if these horses perish, that's the end of the breed, because they have all the stallions, all the mares. They're irreplaceable. But they're German. So what are they supposed to do? they contact Berlin, and of course the Germany was sort of falling apart, and it was very, communication was very difficult. But they contact Berlin, and Berlin says, stay put and fight. Fight, defend this horse farm to the death. Now these guys that are on the farm, they're not actually, they're wearing military uniforms, but they really aren't technically soldiers. They're really horse specialists. That's why they have this important job. And so they don't know what to do. They don't want the horses to be killed. They've got the Russians coming, their own armies telling them that they can't flee with the horses. They have to stay put. And a spy shows up at the farm and pulls them aside, the farm director aside, and he says, you only have one thing you can do. And the stud farm director says, well, what is it? I'm desperate. I need some kind of solution. And the spy says, you have to surrender to the Americans. And the German says, well, first of all, there are no Americans around here. We're in Czechoslovakia. And second, I can't surrender to the Americans. I'm going to be shot for treason. So he doesn't know what to do, doesn't know what to do. And finally, he decides that his only hope is to see if he can follow through with his plan to contact the Americans. So they send one of their veterinarians on one of the Lipizzaner horses to ride, and in order to get to where he thinks the Americans are, he has to ride up through the mountains, these wooded forest mountains that are full of military snipers. So he takes off and he rides, and he gets over to where the Americans are, and he declares his intentions. And the person that he runs into is this American commander, Hank Reed, who loves horses. And he says, okay, I'm going to give you a soldier. He's going to ride back with you across enemy lines and see if he can negotiate for you to surrender this farm. And so the German says, but you're going to have to come get the horses because we can't take them out ourselves. We don't have trucks. These are mares and foals that are, some of them are only a few days old. They can't walk that far. So even if you come, we need to figure out a way to get the horses out before the Russians get there. So the American goes with the German soldier riding the horses through the dark of night, through the forest, to go over to the stud farm. When they get back, it turns out that during this time that they were missing, that the stud farm has been taken over by a higher-ranking German who's planning to use it as his base to fight. And so now they don't know what to do. What happens is the American and the Germans, both horse lovers, team up and decide that they're going to try to figure out a way to get this farm surrendered so that they can get the horses out. And eventually through a series of spy capers that seem like they couldn't possibly be true, but they are, they managed to convince the Russians to hand the horses, to let them surrender the horse farm to the Americans. And eventually the Americans roll in with their tanks.
Wow. And they're saved.
And they're saved, yes.
God, it's such an incredible story. It's a compelling account, really, for anybody who is an animal lover and a World War II buffs alike.
Mm-hmm.
The Perfect Horse tells for the first time, really, the full story of these events.
Yes.
Your exhilarating tale of behind enemy lines, adventure, courage, and sacrifice, because a lot of these guys were killed, right? And some of the horses were slaughtered, even so.
Even, I mean, it was remarkable how they really did manage to save almost all the horses. There were American lives lost during this mission. And I have to tell you that a letter that I received from the nephew of one of the men who was killed on the mission was so meaningful to me. And the amount of pride that that this family has in their uncle who was lost during the war, and knowing that what he ended up doing was saving these horses for posterity, was really, it's an incredible thing. I mean, it was a sacrifice, but it was a sacrifice they were willing to make.
Yeah, and they knew it. And then there was one of the story you tell in the book about this one mare, gray mare, that was in the barn when the Russians came,
mm-hmm.
and she reared up and struck him.
That was Nehada, and that's a famous story in Poland. When the Russians came to steal the Arabians, she refused to go with him. She reared up and she struck him, kicked him, and so she was left behind. And so she was seen as a symbol of Polish resistance.
Oh, That is so great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it's wonderful, and I just I hope people will understand one day that animals, all animals, horses and dogs, particularly for me, but a lot of people are cat lovers and so forth, that there is so much to learn from the animals themselves. And, you know, that first story that you tell in your book about the unlikely Olympian, you know, a horse that was thrown away, basically, and the man was basically thrown away as well, was he not?
Yes, both of them. Told them they weren't good enough, and then they ended up, you know, winning an Olympic bronze medal.
Yeah, and he would have won, except they the Germans didn't want anyone else to win, so they put him in second place or silver medal or something.
Yeah.
So this has been wonderful, Elizabeth, speaking with you. And this book has one of the most inspiring chapters in the annals of human valor, I really believe. And we'll be back in 1 minute after station identification.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening, and I hope that you will read this wonderful book. And Elizabeth Letts can be reached on her website, and hopefully she'll give you this information.
Yes, for more information about me and my books, you can find me at www.elizabethletts.com, and I hope you'll check out The Perfect Horse. It's available wherever books are sold, online and in stores.
That's wonderful. Is there an audiobook with it as well?
There's an audiobook, yeah, and an ebook also.
Oh, that's grand. That's wonderful. And I just so appreciate you being on the show, and very, very much good luck with this book.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. And happy holiday to you.
And to you, too.